Hello there. Today is Thursday, March 28th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, the Trump administration is once again taking aim at revoking the law known as Obamacare.
President Trump said the Republican Party will be the party of health care. If that is true, God help middle-class Americans.
The White House warns Russia about its involvement in Venezuela. Also ahead, the Vatican is being criticized over having all men working on a women's publication. It's all on today's International Edition. U.S. President Donald Trump says Russia has got to get out of Venezuela following the recent arrival of Russian military personnel in the country. Trump making the comments as he spoke to reporters Wednesday at the White House alongside Fabiana Rosales, the wife of Venezuelan opposition leader and self-declared interim president Juan Guaido. VOA's Jeff Custer reports.
Two Russian Air Force planes landed in the capital city of Caracas over the weekend, reportedly carrying a Russian defense official and nearly 100 troops. The arrival comes as the United States, along with dozens of other countries, are pressing Venezuelan leader Nicolas Maduro to step down, to be replaced by opposition leader Guaido.
Russia has to get out. What's your next question?
While Moscow backs Maduro, Trump says all options are on the table, including the military.
All options are open.
He was responding to a reporter's question Wednesday about whether the United States is willing to put boots on the ground to remove the Russians. The American president also assured Fabiano Rosales that the U.S. is going to get it all worked out, while also criticizing Maduro over the failure of efforts to get humanitarian aid into Venezuela.
We've sent hundreds of millions of dollars worth of aid to the border. He won't take the aid. He'd rather have his people starve than take the aid. I don't think that's good, even from a political standpoint. Even from a dictator standpoint, I don't think that's good.
For her part, Rosales said children in her country are dying in hospitals, which are without electricity or medical supplies, while other children are succumbing because they have no food. Guaido in Venezuela Wednesday has called on supporters to protest this Saturday against nationwide power outages. Jeff Custer, VOA News, Washington.
Meanwhile, as the president noted, Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro continues refusing to allow aid into the country, where citizens are living in dire conditions. I talked about that earlier with Carlos Moreo, professor at Australian National University at the National Center for Latin American Studies. What is the situation? Is it as desperate as it seems?
I mean, the situation in Venezuela is, of course, dramatic. And we've seen this now reported on the media. We've seen footage, and we've also heard Venezuelans speak about this not only in the last couple of weeks, but really over the last year and a half, 2 years or so. The crisis affects Venezuelans from all walks of life. It's an economic crisis, but, of course, it's also a social crisis. So there's food shortages and the hospitals understaffed and are also lacking essential medical supplies. And so the crisis is, of course, real and dramatic. But the situation on humanitarian aid is kind of more complex. The government of Maduro has always stated, perhaps cynically, that humanitarian intervention is really just a pretext for a military intervention, right? So they've always encountered that. And you can see, I guess, from the government's perspective, how allowing humanitarian aid to enter the country would be a kind of admission or recognition of the Maduro government's failure to address the plight of the people and to address the crisis. And on the other hand, kind of the regional coalition of the group of Lima countries and the U.S., et cetera, would see humanitarian aid or the happening of humanitarian aid as an important event because it would signal to the world that humanitarian aid was necessary. It would signal to the world that, in fact, yes, there is a crisis and we're not meddling in the country and undermining its sovereignty, but rather by offering humanitarian aid and by having this happen, this is a demonstration of the crisis, something that, of course, the government has repeatedly denied.
U.N. Secretary General Antonio Guterres said he really hopes that no foreign forces enter Venezuela. U.S. President Donald Trump said he didn't rule out sending troops in.
Military intervention is certainly a concern. I mean, the strategic game that the opposition is playing here, with Juan Guaido as leader of the National Assembly and self-proclaimed, according to some, as interim president, and having the U.S. on side and having, in some sense, a threat of military intervention is ostensibly an important part of their kind of bargaining position and a protection of Guaido. Nevertheless, I mean, military intervention would be catastrophic. It would be absolutely catastrophic for the country. The Venezuelan military is large, and you know, we have militias, and you know, we have kind of different sort of components. We We've seen exercises within Venezuela in the last couple of days, you know, where the military have come out and sworn their allegiance to Maduro and kind of stated that, you know, that they would defend the country. And fortunately, you know, there are some actors within Venezuela and were also an international actors, you know, so governments who have said that, you know, they don't want military intervention. So, for example, the Grupo de Lima, right, the Lima group, which essentially brings together the Latin American countries such as Colombia, Brazil, Peru, Chile, and others who are supporting the opposition and who are the countries, the Latin American countries that first came out to recognize Guaido. In a recent statement, they one of the points in the communique was that they did not support military intervention. So that's important. It's important that pro-opposition actors such as Grupo de Lima also come out against military intervention. Now, of course, this means that then the outcome, and this is the outcome that all Venezuelans we would like to see, is an outcome that leads us to elections or an outcome that leads us to a legitimate government in some way.
The other factor in all of this is Venezuela is a very oil-rich country and an important one regarding that with the United States and other nations. How does oil factor in to all of this, particularly when it comes to trying to oust Maduro?
Oil is clearly a part of the story. The latest moves we've seen in trying to pressure the government of Maduro to concede power and support Guaido, you know, has to do with U.S. sanctions on PDVSA, right? The U.S. government adopted sanctions on Venezuela's state-owned company, PDVSA, and on Citgo. And National Security Advisor John Bolton said that this would mean freezing up something like $7 billion in assets in the country and close to $11 billion in revenue. And this would happen as of the 28th of April, so still a few weeks away. But this would essentially mean that the government of Maduro would find it very difficult to fund its programs and very difficult, in fact, to import foodstuff to try and address the crisis of Venezuela. So the sanctions are an important part of the story, and of course, they're trying to affect the resources that the oil company brings into the country. And PDVSA itself has been in crisis as well, right? So, and the sanctions aren't helping, and in fact, these sanctions really add to the sanctions that we had from last year. But the Venezuelan oil company, PDVSA, has also been in crisis and has seen its production plummeting in the last 2 years. So we're barely an oil-producing state right now.
All right, that's Carlos Moreo, professor at Australian National University at the National Center for Latin American Studies. Well, healthcare has reemerged as a major focus of U.S. political parties, with the Trump administration once again taking aim at the Affordable Care Act. It is advocating to strike the entire law down, also known as Obamacare, as Democrats introduce legislation to strengthen the law that's been in place since 2010. The Justice Department Monday backed a federal court ruling declaring the entire ACA unconstitutional on the basis that without the fines for not having health insurance, the mandate for having coverage shouldn't be allowed. Trump told reporters Tuesday he wanted alternatives to the law, which was one of the key policies enacted under his predecessor, Barack Obama.
The Republican Party will soon be known as the Party of Healthcare.
You watch.
House Speaker Nancy Pelosi unveiled Democratic proposals she says would improve the existing law while accusing Republicans of working only to destroy the affordable health care of America's families.
Last night, in federal court, the Justice Department of the Trump administration, you think they'd have more to do, decided not only to try to destroy protections for pre-existing conditions, but to tear down every last benefit and protection the ACA affords.
But Republican House Minority Whip Steve Scalise says Obamacare isn't working and the GOP is developing a better plan.
Obamacare has failed the American people. If you look at health care costs, they've been rising dramatically for everybody, including people with pre-existing conditions who in many cases are seeing double-digit increases every single year. Some people have $10,000 deductibles, which makes health care unaffordable.
Well, joining us to talk more about it is attorney Harry Nelson, managing partner of the Los Angeles healthcare law firm Nelson Hardiman and author of the book From Obamacare to Trump Care, Why You Should Care. Harry, thanks for being with us. What's the administration trying to do to get the law overturned?
Until Tuesday, we were waiting to see if the Supreme Court was going to take up this Texas federal court decision striking down several parts of the Affordable Care Act. What happened on Tuesday that was changing the game a little bit is that President Trump announced that he intends to bring some new attempt to repeal the entire Affordable Care Act, including the Medicaid expansion component. So that's what really changed the game Tuesday.
What is the likelihood of this whole entire law becoming obsolete? Would this be something that could actually happen? Or is this, because they've certainly made a lot of efforts to try to get rid of Obamacare and so far have been unsuccessful.
So it's interesting to divide up the two parts of the Affordable Care Act, the Medicaid expansion and the health insurance exchanges. It seems that there is Republican support, at least in Congress, for not returning to the Medicaid debate. In the spring of 2017, the president had expressed support for repeal of Medicaid, and Senate Republicans led that effort, but it ultimately failed because 9 Republican senators jumped over and voted against repeal or rollback of the Medicaid expansion. And that was significant because we have at least 12 million Americans who have gotten Medicaid as a result of the Affordable Care Act. On the other side, the health insurance exchanges have been wobbly and struggling from the inception, and so it's much more likely that we'll see further undoing of those commercial exchanges. But I think it's extremely unlikely that there'll be support at the end of the day for a true rollback.
The thing is, we're not even talking about Congress here. We're talking about the Justice Department backing a federal court ruling and asking the courts, basically, to overturn the whole law. So it doesn't sound like the Republicans are excited about this becoming a political issue, but can the courts literally do this now at this point just because they ask for it?
So the only thing that the president can do is direct the Solicitor General and the Department of Justice to argue that the entire law should be struck down, which is a new position. The only way that the courts can actually take that action is if 5 justices on the Supreme Court agreed with the Department of Justice and the president's position. But my best sense is that the Supreme Court is not eager to hear any case about the Affordable Care Act. Again, we've already had 3 major decisions from the Supreme Court on the Affordable Care Act, and so it's possible. We're going to have to wait and see if the Supreme Court will actually accept cert and hear the case, but at that point, the president's decision would be impactful. But if the Supreme Court doesn't hear the case, then this is purely a theoretical conversation.
If for some reason this law was overturned, how would this impact Americans who are depending on it and the healthcare system in general?
So between the Medicaid and the private exchanges, we're talking about 20 million Americans who would be left uninsured, which is about a 60%+ increase in the number of uninsured patients. It would be a huge problem for those people and their families. It would also be a huge problem for hospitals and doctors who provide care with them. We'd see another $50 billion in uncompensated care. So it would be a catastrophic event to see a true rollback at this point.
That's Harry Nelson, managing partner of Los Angeles healthcare law firm Nelson Hardiman. He's also the author of the book From Obamacare to Trump Care, Why You Should Care. Here are some of the stories we are following at voanews.com. Prime Minister May says she'll quit once Britain leaves the EU. Arrivals at the U.S. southern border are overwhelming the system. Boeing says its new software for its 737 MAX jets is almost ready. And Democrats push for the public release of the Mueller report. Find expanded coverage of these stories and more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. More than 100 of the Chibok schoolgirls remain in captivity nearly 5 years after Boko Haram militants in Nigeria abducted them from their school. President Muhammadu Buhari promised to make the rescue of the girls and other abductees a top priority. Some have been released, but advocacy groups say Buhari's government, in its focus on the economy, has largely forgotten the girls who are still being held. Timothy Obaizu reports from Abuja.
Charity Job last saw her daughter Awa on the morning of April 14, 2014, when she left for school in Chibok, Nigeria. Awa is among the 276 girls who were abducted by Boko Haram and one of the 112 still in captivity.
The insurgents came and took our children, including mine and those of my relatives from their school. Some of us developed high blood pressure and died as a result of the incident. We that survived, we have children. If I die, who will take care of them?
The mass abduction of the girls in 2014 triggered a global outcry and sparked the creation of the Bring Back Our Girls campaign, BBOG, in Nigeria. And for nearly 5 years, parents like Charity have been hoping their children will return home one day.
We've been coming from time to time to search for our girls. Sometimes when we come, we have to wait for the sun to go down. Some people faint from the heat, and sometimes we go back very starved.
But advocacy group BBOG is accusing the government is not doing enough to ensure the release of the remaining girls. The group is recording fewer numbers at rallies, but Kapani Yanga, rally coordinator, says they will not relent until the government responds.
Since the 106 Chibok girls are released, we have not heard anything from the from federal government. Federal government have to stand up, or have to stand up to their responsibility.
The government secured the safe release of some 21 girls in October 2016 and another 82 in May 2017. Al-Kazim Abdulkadir is spokesperson of the Presidential Committee for Northeast Initiative. He says it is negotiating the release of more girls.
And I'm sure very soon we'll reach a middle ground where some of the abductees will be released to their families and to the society at large.
In 2015, then-candidate Buhari promised the release of the abducted Chibok girls and others taken by Boko Haram would be his top priority. But observers say in recent years, the president has focused largely on the economy. On the fifth anniversary of the girls' abduction, advocacy groups like Bring Back Our Girls are calling on him to remember his first promise to bring the missing Chibok girls back to their families. Timothy Obiezu, VOA News, Abuja.
India says it successfully tested an anti-satellite missile. It marks another major development in its budding space program. Prime Minister Narendra Modi announced in a nationally televised address that scientists had destroyed the satellite orbiting about 300 kilometers above the Earth's atmosphere in a mission that lasted just 3 minutes. The prime minister said the country has now registered itself as a major space power, along with the United States, Russia, and China. VOA Asia's Ira Melman gets reaction from Joe Cirincione with the Plowshares Fund.
Well, India now has become only the fourth country that can do this. This is a little bit of we told you so. When the U.S. and the Soviet Union started testing these weapons, many of us warned that if you kept doing this, that other countries would follow, and this would make it extremely dangerous, and we would end up being the loser. The U.S. has more satellites in space than any other country, in fact, than most countries combined. India has now followed suit. It won't be the last unless we do something about this. And I would have to disagree with Mr. Modi. I don't think India has become a space power. It already was that. It already has the ability to launch satellites. Today it became a space polluter. The test has now put in orbit hundreds of particles, maybe thousands of debris particles, any one of which could destroy a peaceful commercial satellite if it hits it.
This seems to be a different trajectory from what we have grown up with as far as space travel is concerned, landing men on the moon, research, scientific findings. How did we get here?
During the last years of the Cold War, the U.S. and the Soviet Union started to play around with weapons that could knock each other's satellites out of space, mainly surveillance satellites. India is now taking notice of this, and this is almost certainly aimed at knocking Pakistan satellites. Just in the last year, Pakistan launched two surveillance satellites using a Chinese launch to do that, and it may be that India is sending a message to Pakistan. It's also aimed at China, a threat to knock out China's weapons. It's also a little bit of an electoral ploy. Mr. Moody's up for election in a few weeks, and he's trying to show that he's tough, and so there's never underestimate the domestic p- parts of this. The danger is that this is part of a new arms race that we're in. Countries are building new nuclear weapons. They're developing new anti-satellite weapons now. They're developing new anti-missile weapons. And the U.S., which used to take the lead in curtailing these kinds of arms races, is sitting on the sidelines.
Well, the other side of this story is that if other nations could be foes of us, whoever us might be, that we have to protect ourselves from a possible attack from a satellite.
Well, that is true. So you have, in the U.S., you see a new push for a space force. And what they mean is they want to have a space warfare capability. So to put up weapons in space, to put up perhaps armed, you know, human beings in space vehicles that could orbit and then come back down, that could use space as a place to attack other countries. Well, if you're going to start doing that, then yes, people are going to start developing anti-satellite weapons. And the threat is really that in the process of doing this, in the process just of testing these weapons, you could have severe international commercial implications.
What do you do about it?
You have to have an anti-satellite treaty. And people have been suggesting this for years. You can do this. You can get countries to agree not to deploy these kinds of weapons. The U.S. thought it would have a unique advantage in this field. The Indian test shows that that's just not true. We have to nip this in the bud before we have dozens of countries testing these kinds of weapons.
That's VOA Asia's Ira Melman speaking to Joe Cirincione with the Plowshares Fund. You're listening to International Edition on VOA.
Voice of America's news, talk, and music programs are now at the tip of your fingers. Find everything at www.voaafrica.com. Listen to VOA's program lineup live, anytime, day or night. Pick out your favorite shows and listen anytime you want. Download our podcasts. Check VOA Mobile from your cell phone. Subscribe to VOA Newsfeed. VOAnews.com.
Hi, I'm Nikki Strong. You love music? How about Blake Shelton and Carrie Underwood? Or Merle Haggard and Loretta Lynn? Experience the best in country music on Country Hits USA. I bring you some country rock, outlaw, a little hillbilly, contemporary, and more, with a dash of entertainment news, too. So join me for Country Hits USA on VOA 1, the voice of America.
VOA's International Edition continues. Well, the founder and all-female editorial board of the Vatican's women's magazine have resigned to protest what they call a campaign to discredit them and put them under the direct control of men. The editorial committee of Women Church World, a monthly supplement to the Vatican Daily, La Osservatore Romano, claims the Daily's new editor has sabotaged the magazine after it denounced sexual abuse of nuns by the clergy. VOA's Latika Hoke has more.
The Catholic Church has a history of hiding abuses committed by its clergy and protecting the perpetrators. But new revelations of abuse continue to emerge. An article published in the February issue of the Vatican's women's magazine contained reports by nuns recounting sexual abuse by priests. Some said they had been forced to have abortions, which is against the church's teaching.
We've received many reports of these abusive situations, so at a certain point we had to talk about it. If not, we would have lost the trust of the women who wrote to us, who reported these things.
Lucetta Scaraffia, the founder of Women Church World, says the new editor of L'Osservatore Romano planned to take over the magazine at the beginning of the year, but backed off when she and all the female editors threatened to resign. But she says after the publication of the article on the abuse of nuns, L'Osservatore began a campaign to sabotage the women's magazine.
First, there was an attempt on the part of the new director to participate himself in our meetings and to invite people to participate in a way that never happened before, breaking up a tight group that had worked together for many years. We managed to block this attempt, but then what happened was we noticed a form of delegitimization of our work That is, articles in the daily newspaper that addressed the role of women in the church from a point very different from our own, without us being able to respond. It was like there were two separate souls in the newspaper, one opposite ours. As we did not want to have women confronting women, so we decided to end this experience after 7 years.
The article on the abuse of nuns has been praised for breaking ages of silence on the issue. Following its publication, Pope Francis acknowledged the abuse has happened.
We were a real novelty in the Vatican, a new initiative because we were born spontaneously, not chosen from above. We created it. We got the permission from Pope Benedict. We've always run it ourselves. We chose who ran the magazine. We chose ourselves, the people who were part of the editorial committee. It was an interesting intellectual laboratory.
The director of L'Osservatore Romano, Andrea Monda, issued a statement denying attempts to weaken the women's magazine. He said he wanted other female voices and viewpoints on the pages of the Vatican's daily paper. Zlatica Hoke, VOA News, Washington.
Norwegian up-and-coming musician, a Norwegian up-and-coming musician, is becoming what the New York Times describes as the gay musical role model she never had. Marie Ulven began writing songs when she was just 16 and released her first home-recorded indie pop song, I Wanna Be Your Girlfriend, under the name Girl in Red. She's now 20 years old, and her music has blossomed into a growing phenomenon with more than a million monthly followers on Spotify, with just 10 songs posted. The songs are a mix of guitar flair and very candid lyrics. She says she suppressed her feelings about being gay for a long time, despite having dreams about girls and waking up feeling guilty. She says the fact that gay people still need to say they've, quote, come out, indicates the gay community is still not seen as the social norm as it is with straight people. And you've been listening to International Edition. That does it for today's show, but you can find us anytime at voanews.com. Thank you for joining us, and thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Greg Burns. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a wonderful day.
This is James Butte, Managing Editor and host of VOA's Daybreak Africa show. Join us Monday through Friday at 03, 04, 05, and 0600 hours UTC as we bring you the latest Africa news, features, and sports. You can also be a part of Daybreak Africa through our mail segment by sending your comments to daybreakafrica at voanews.com. That's Daybreak Africa right here on VOA Africa.
This is VOA News.